This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're still eating turkey on Thanksgiving Day, but a lot has changed since 1971, when Madeline Kamen published the first edition of her book, The Making of a Cook. The book taught Americans how to apply classic French cooking techniques to American ingredients. Kamen has updated it to take into account Americans' changing tastes and health concerns. Kamen grew up in France and moved to America with her husband in 1960. She's since run her own restaurants and cooking schools and hosted a PBS cooking show that ran from 1984 to 91. She now runs the School for American Chefs in the Napa Valley. I asked her about some of the ways she thinks American eating has changed since the 1971 edition of her book.
Major ways is a complete lightening of the textures of food by removing a lot of fat out of it for medical reasons and for reasonable reasons too, presenting it in a very different manner. Some people continue to be very, very plain, simple, letting the food speak for itself. Mostly professional do decorations that can be outrageous. On a nutritional way, nutrition has really received a large amount of focus, and I think it is a very good thing because we used too much fat and too much butter before. So I have insisted in this book that it be made in a reasonable way, preaching moderation in the consumption of everything, not only the amount of food one eats. You may have noticed that the recipes are small recipes rather than very large recipes with portions that are reasonable, and especially the fat be controlled so that one eats a large amount of unsaturated fat supplemented by a small reasonable amount of saturated fat.
Well, take us back to 1971 when your book first came out. What were some of the thoughts and eating styles that you tried to tie into then?
Well, this was the time of the dying classic French cuisine. What happened is that it goes back to the time of the war, and to find out what happened with the cuisine nouvelle, it goes back in the 1940s, the late 1940s and the early 50s in France. We had, during the war years, had absolutely nothing to eat. It was so dire that we ate very, very weird things. We hunted rabbits with a noose and things like this. I've done this myself. I regret it immensely. But it was a question of survival. And we became, all of us, very, very lean, so lean that we were very thin and not very appetizing to look at. We did not look good. But when the food came back in 1946 to 47, everything was back in full production. As a reaction against those lean years, we started to eat enormously, and we all put on a terrible amount of weight. That was all right for the teenager. I was a teenager at that time. But some of the adults started to look a little funny, which is not the case generally in France. And that's the time when I started to talk about dietetics in France. And the idea slowly went from the doctor's office to the people, from the people. It passed through new generations of chefs. So what happened is that the food, for two reasons, dietetic and also economic, started to really simplify itself. So at the time I published the first book, you have noticed that all the recipes are really full of butter and cream. And this is quite amazing that I look at it now and I say, oh my goodness gracious, why did I do that? This was celebration food. This was not food that you would eat every day. All the recipes in the old book are mostly celebration recipes.
So in the new book, your recipes are a lot leaner than they were the first time
indeed,
around.
Indeed, yeah, indeed. And I was not the only one. You remember Mrs. Child's book. It was Nice Rich Cooking, and it represents some of the old cuisine that we kept as celebration. Meanwhile, the chefs were working parallelly to lighten everything on the restaurant table.
Now, you came to France from the United States in the early 1960s, and you say that when you came here, you started using French cooking techniques with American ingredients.
Yeah, that was a brand new world. You know, I came in 1960, exactly the 15th of February, and I went to the store, and I looked at things, and I couldn't find anything with which I was familiar. I could not recognize the cuts of meat, because cuts of meat are not cut in the same direction. In Europe, we follow the length of the long muscles to make the cuts, the roast, the steaks, and so on. Here, it's cut across the grain, and it's really not quite the same. So it took me a little while. So one day I roasted a pot roast, and it was not very successful until my husband explained to me what a pot roast was. This was the very beginning of the large production of food that is produced, mass-produced. And that was the very beginning of the convenience food. The convenience food came almost on my heels, literally. I arrived in this country, and the convenience food arrived within 2 years after me. And I looked at this, and I said, this is really funny. It has a funny taste. So I decided that there were other things that I could use that didn't have that taste, and I was going to work with them personally, create a relationship between the sweet potatoes, between the beautiful squashes that we had here, between the different vegetables that I did not know. I never ate corn before I came to the United States. We don't eat corn in Europe. It's for fodder most of the time. And even to this day, if they eat corn, they get it out of a can. It's really interesting. So I had to recreate a complete new classic cuisine using American ingredients. And I really enjoyed it. It was very, very nice.
I know that you're working on a poultry book now.
Yes, I have, yeah.
And I've read a lot of alarming things about the contamination of uncooked chicken, the bacteria that a lot of uncooked chicken has. And I'm wondering what you do at home or at a restaurant to take precautions when you're working with chicken.
Well, when I came from Europe, I looked at those chicken, and people would wash the chicken, and I would say, are you crazy? Nobody washes a chicken. And I didn't wash the chicken because I wasn't used to wash it. And then all of a sudden I realized that the more I read on sanitation on the skin of the chicken is fatal because it allows bacteria to develop. Where the French chicken that I had been raised with were very powdery dry. The skins are very, very dry. There is never an ounce of moisture on a French chicken. The skin is like velvet. You can pass your hand on it. It feels like velvet and completely dry. So whether this is better or not, and the techniques they use are better than ours, I'm sure they have the same problem because it came when chicken started to be raised 5,000 in a cage, you know. And they pick at each other, they hate each other, they don't have enough space. They are like people. If somebody is with you too close, you get upset. Well, the chicken get very upset. I went to visit a chicken center, and one dear man was raising chicken that are free range. And those that were free range and had much more space could go out through the window during the day and pick at worms outside in their beautiful yard full of nice grass. They were much better looking than those that were not free range chicken. So there's all kinds of things that are done. There are good chickens in America, most definitely. But there are some that get contaminated because something happens on the way, most of the time.
I feel like I'm becoming a little crazy when I prepare chicken at home. You know, I wash my hands every time I touch it.
Well, you should wear gloves.
Yeah, you should wear gloves, huh?
Mm-hmm. I think the vinyl gloves are very good when you touch chicken and fish, if you can. There is another thing that you can do is to wash the chicken, obviously, but the best thing is to marinate it in lemon juice and a little salt. It just discolors a little bit the meat outside, but it sterilizes the meat outside. And the skin is much better for consumption. Furthermore, it makes it nice and mellow, and it tastes good.
So how soon should you do that before cooking?
About a half an hour before cooking. You just put lemon juice on it and a little dash of salt and let it sit with the lemon juice all around. And that will, completely discard some of the bacteria, so you can handle it with your hand at that point. The same as you would wash a table top with lemon juice and salt and then wipe it dry afterwards so that you decontaminate it. You do the same to the chicken. And it doesn't damage the chicken. On the contrary, it gives it a nice texture and a nice taste.
Now, this is how you wash tabletops with lemon juice and salt?
Yes, I wash them first with soap and water and let them air dry, rinse them well and let them air dry, and then I put salt and lemon juice to completely sterilize it, and then fresh water again. It's quite very careful. You have to be very careful when you wash those boards and those tabletops. Now, don't believe that I'm obnubilated by bacteria. I am not, but it's good to take precautions.
You also warn your readers about cross-contamination.
That's the worst. Yeah. That is really something that is not observed enough. And I can understand why.
Explain what the problem is.
The problem is the following. Let's say that you have cleaned the chicken or a steak or anything, remove the fat from a steak on a board. And you do not wash the board, and on the same board you take a piece of bologna and you cut it on the board and you put your slice of bread there. The bacteria can jump from one to the other in no time, and they are going to develop in your sandwich or whatever you're doing, and you're going to get mighty sick, you know. So the cross, you bring the contamination from one ingredient that is uncooked to one ingredient that is cooked, and that is fatal, really, because you can really poison yourself, and not poison to the point, understand me, you're not going to die of it, but you may have a good case of a nasty stomach over it, or nasty inside, and you don't want to have it. It's not necessary. Furthermore, some people are very sensitive to it. Young children and very older person are not so resistant to it, and they can get very, very ill.
Now, we have Thanksgiving coming up. I'm wondering if you could maybe share a stuffing recipe with us.
Well, yes, if you want. And I'll tell you what I do. It never goes into the turkey. Because if you put it into the turkey, you can make a mistake really fast. Making your stuffing means mixing all kinds of ingredients that should not be put in the turkey, then the turkey left stuffed without being baked. If you use a stuffing that goes into the turkey, number one, you will not have a very good gravy, because as the turkey cooks, it loses its gravy inside of the stuffing, and you're going to have less into your pan. So I tend to do what my mother-in-law did, actually. My husband's mother, she had a very lovely way of doing a stuffing. She would prepare a stuffing with the usual bread, either cornbread or white bread or rye bread, and onions, shallots, and all kinds of aromatics that she liked, and also a little bit of sausage, which made it really delicious, a good sausage stuffing, and use one that has that good American taste of sage. I love it. So what she did, she baked the stuffing under the turkey on the lower shelf while the turkey was 3/4 down. She would put a stuffing to cook under. And since in France we stuff exclusively with chestnuts, which I love too, the chestnuts are cooked before, or 3/4 cooked before you put them inside. So you still get the gravy and the chestnut absorb a certain amount of it, but not the whole amount. But the bread stuffing will absorb every gravy that comes from the cavity of the bird. So try to put it in a dish. You'll see it's very different. It has a very nice taste because it's browned on the top and it's moist inside, and it tastes really good. And you can still serve it with a portion of turkey. And the meat of the turkey will taste better because you won't have to cook the turkey so long. You have to cook it to 180 degrees between the leg and the breast. This is quite essential for resolve of this problem of bacteria.
With your stuffing recipe, for people who don't eat sausage, is there something you think
we can
substitute?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You can do substitution. That's no problem. You're going to make a Mediterranean tasting one if you would like. It's very easy. You take the same breadcrumb. You take garlic, parsley, mashed anchovy. You can put grated orange rind. You can put pine nuts. You can imagine all this yourself. You know, you do not have to follow a recipe. All you need is the technique for baking, so to say, a bread pudding. Eh? Since you put milk in it and you bake this in the oven, it's a savory bread pudding, basically. So if you don't want the sausage, you don't put it. Like if people are vegetarian, you don't even have to serve them the turkey, you know. You can serve them the vegetarian stuffing all by itself, and they're very happy. It's very nice.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Madeline Kamen, and she has just revised her 1971 book, The Making of a Cook. And the new Making of a Cook is much larger and takes into account more contemporary approaches to eating and to cooking. And Madeline Kamen had her own PBS show. She's run restaurants. She teaches chefs. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. Back with Madeline Kamen, who has just updated her 1971 book, The Making of a Cook. I'm interested in your food autobiography. You grew up in France. What did your family cook when you were very young?
Well, my mother was a working woman. The women in my family have worked since the First World War. I was brought up with extremely simple food that one could afford with a regular salary. That means that my mother would get out of work at noon, and she would stop at the butcher, pick up steaks for the family. She would have potatoes always in the cellar. Go get the potatoes in the cellar. I would peel them. She would cut them. She would fry them. She would cook the steaks. I would make the salad. And that was lunch. And we had the same meal at night. There was always a soup ready at night, which was made, which I jokingly used to call garbage soup because it's all the cutout of all the vegetables of the week, all the pieces of vegetables that don't look good enough to go on a plate. I keep them and I put them in a bag and I make a vegetable soup. Everybody has their vegetable soup in France every night to this day. And in many families, one has soup, a piece of cheese and fruit, and this is dinner. The big meal is still at noon, especially in the French provinces. But things are getting a little more difficult now because everybody really works and there is more and more food that is prepared. And the generations of now don't know the taste of homemade food. See, however simple my steak may have been, it's interesting to realize that the steak was a weekday item because it was fat, or a lamb chop, or and chicken, which was the breast chicken, the beautiful chicken with the blue feet. Chicken and ham, whole ham, and a roast beef or a roast leg of lamb were for Sunday exclusively and for receiving friends and family. This is what I ate. Not too many sauces. I had two Espanol sauces in my family. One was on my Holy Communion day, and the other one was on my wedding day. Otherwise, we did not have these sauces. We had them when we went to the restaurant.
You've said that during World War II, when there was a food shortage, that many French people resorted to things like hunting rabbits. Did you do that yourself?
Yes, I did. My father and I went and put nooks between stretched piano wire, between two bendable trees, and the poor little rabbit that would pass through that, because we had put a lovely piece of carrot beyond that was very attractive, lost his life as moving forward, the neck would be squeezed tighter and tighter. But we had to do it. There were millions of rabbits in those forests. I mean, millions. You could see them cross the streets. You know, the roads in the countryside? Mm-hmm. There were so many, we didn't know what to do with them, so it was a good source of food.
What did it do to your sense of food to actually hunt it yourself?
Well, it removed the squeamishness that sometimes we have, you know. I used to go shoot pheasant with my father and the dog, and it was interesting, or with my grandfather and the dog. It was interesting to see the sharp, what sharpshooters these men were. That was really nice. But I lost my stomach for it later. I lost my enthusiasm because, I don't know, it became, as I got older, first I changed religion as I got older, and there is such a respect of law in the religion of life, in the religion that I have chosen, that I would not do that anymore. I'm a vegetarian now.
You're a vegetarian now?
Yes, ma'am. I am.
Well, yeah, but you're writing a new book on poultry.
Well, that doesn't matter. As a cook, I have to be able to know how to cook everything. The fact that I'm vegetarian by choice doesn't mean that I should know my trade as a chef.
But how do you feel if tell me more about why you're a vegetarian?
Oh, I'm a Buddhist.
Oh. So you don't want to consume meat, but it's okay for you to prepare it to test out recipes for the book?
Well, of course.
Right.
And I even have to taste it.
Right.
Yeah, I have to taste it. It creates a little situation, but it's not dire because, you know, I'm not a Tibetan Buddhist where it's so very important. I'm a Western Buddhist, and if we have to taste meat, we taste meat, very simply. I have to for my work, so I do it. And I've eaten meat for many, many, many years. I stopped it basically out of philosophy, as I just said, and also because of that cholesterol problem. So the two went very well hand in hand, and it was very interesting to change completely.
Are you going to have a vegetarian Thanksgiving?
Oh, no. Oh, no. I'm not cooking it. I can impose my ideas or my wants on everybody. So most of the time, I will have a tiny bit of turkey and a lot of the stuffing without... I'm going to ask that a little bit of the stuffing be put away without the sausage in it, which is not very good for me, although I had some this morning. You see how treacherous it can be to be away in the world by yourself. There is no good body to say, come on, don't eat this, it's not good. But I don't know. I'll see what is on the table. I don't want to create a fuss. You know, it's not necessary. And it's not going to kill me. Or whatever my spiritual ideas are, if I eat a little piece of sausage or a little piece of turkey, I'm not going to upset everybody. Let them do what they want. This is my younger son who's going to do this, and he's a past master at Turkey. So I always like when he cooks because he cooks it better than I do.
Actually, I think you give his recipe for turkey in
your book.
Yes, I do.
That's yeah,
right.
I do.
You want to give us that recipe, maybe?
Oh, well, yeah. What he does, he cooks the turkey, and then when the turkey is done, he either covers the breast seriously so it doesn't continue cooking with paper, it doesn't transfer the heat to it, or he simply removes the breast and keeps it and finishes the legs for another half hour. And this way, the turkey is very good, and either the stuffing will go in, but most of the time, he will put the stuffing in for a certain amount of time, then he will finish baking it in a dish. He's much more complicated than I am, and it tastes really good, you know. So these are just ideas. I could not tell you exactly what he puts in everything, because he won't ever tell me, so it's up to me to guess. It's a good guessing game. I love that. Guessing what's in a dish, you know.
Madeline Kemen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Madeline Kemen is the author of The New Making of a Cook, The Art, Techniques, and Science of Good Cooking.